happy Friday, everybody. Welcome to my program, the Michael Cutler Hour. Appropriately enough, my name is Michael Cutler. I welcome you. I always enjoy spending an hour with you at the end of what I hope was a good week for all of you. Those of you who are tuning in for the first time, just by way of introducing myself briefly, I am a retired senior special agent with what used to be the INS, and ever since the attacks of 9/11, as a New Yorker, as an American, as a former law enforcement officer, I've decided that I needed to provide my perspectives on the immigration component to what has gone wrong, not only where national security is concerned, although that is my primary focus, but where a whole host of other issues are concerned. You know, I'd like to remind people that immigration is not a single issue, but a singular issue that impacts virtually every threat and challenge that our country and our citizens are facing today, a challenge that politicians from both sides of the aisle, have failed to adequately address, so that we have now wound up in this unbelievable situation where our borders apparently only exist on maps, and where at present there are millions, if not in fact tens of millions, of illegal aliens in our country who are here in violation of law, whose identities are unknown and unknowable, and therefore we have no idea, basically, of knowing who they are, who they're affiliated with, what their backgrounds might be, or what their ultimate goals might be. Rather than delve into the intricacies of my biography, I would suggest that you go to my website, michaelcutler.net, and you could read more about me, but I will tell you that I did spend 30 years with the old INS, and I've done a bunch of congressional hearings. I've worked with various state and local governments on the immigration issue, and I currently do whatever I can to get a clear, coherent message out there. And by the way, for clarity, immigration is not a conservative issue or a liberal issue. It's an American issue, plain and simple. There are three websites, really, that I would love for you to visit. So at the outset, let me tell you what they are. Take out your crayon and jot them down. I've just mentioned michaelcutler.net, C-U-T-L-E-R, Michael Cutler. That's me. Also, I am very proud to tell you that I am a senior fellow with an organization known as CAPS, Californians for Population Stabilization. They're on the West Coast. I'm on the East Coast, but through the magic of computers, telephones, and occasionally airliners, I find it very rewarding, very satisfying to work with those folks whose headquarters is located, as they say, in beautiful downtown Santa Barbara. Beautiful place I've been to a number of times. Always love going out there. Great people to be found out there. And again, their organization's website is CAPS web, CAPS web.org. I do a lot of writing for them, as do other people, and they do a great job of providing a clear message about why immigration really needs to be done in a controlled, logical, legal fashion. And finally, I have a new website that I'm very proud of. It's called Talk Border, if I can only get my own words out straight. It's talkborder.com. And that's one word, T-A-L-K-B-O-R-D-E-R, talkborder.com. And on talkborder.com, I have posted some of my commentaries. I've done a couple of what they like to refer to as monologues, where I've sat in front of a camera for 24 or 25 minutes and provided perspectives on immigration, as I would do at hearings or on TV shows or radio programs. And I've also conducted a bunch of interviews with some truly unique and qualified people, not just talking heads as we see too often in the evening news, so-called, but people who really have a perspective worth considering, even if you may disagree with them. They are the voice of knowledge and experience. A couple of weeks ago, I was honored to have Congressman Lou Barletta join me. I've had other folks, including today's guest who will be on my radio program, David Meyer Levy, who was a history professor in California, is an expert on Middle Eastern terrorism, and knows from whence he speaks. David Meyer Levy is joining me tonight, and in fact, let me welcome him to our program. David, are you there?
I am here.
Well, that's great. I'm sort of here. I'm not all here, perhaps. But I thank you for joining me, and I wish you and everybody out there a happy Friday. How are you this evening?
I am fine, thank God.
Good. Why don't we start our conversation with the lunacy that seems to be passing for immigration policy these days. You know, we had this conversation earlier today as we prepared for today's show, and we were talking about the impact of not only the massive numbers of illegal aliens in our country, but the insanity being foisted apparently upon us by the president, claiming executive privilege, if you will. He's actually calling it prosecutorial discretion. I call it prosecutorial deception. But you made some interesting points. So why don't you, for the sake of my audience, first of all, tell them a little bit about yourself, and then let's get into what we talked about today, about what we are concerned will be the impact of the misuse or mislabeling of prosecutorial discretion.
Right. Okay. Well, a little about myself, just very briefly. I now live in New York. I formerly was an academic, both in this country and in Israel. And for the past, I'd say, 12 years or so, I've been working at a research analysis, a publication, commentary in media, in several books and numerous articles that I've written about the whole issue of the Middle East and about terrorism in particular. And that's an issue which dovetails very closely with the issue of immigration, because illegal immigration into the USA, primarily from Mexico, has become a pipeline for infiltrating Arab and Iranian terrorists into the USA. We can get into that in more detail later, but the important thing for now is that this means that it's just not a matter of protecting American jobs or the American economy or competition with workers. It's actually a matter of national security. The FBI estimated back in 2006 that somewhere around 5,000 per year illegal immigrants coming out of Mexico, looking like Mexicans, dressed up in Mexican clothing, were entering the country, and they were, rather than being Mexican or South American in any way, they were in fact Arabian Arabs, in other words, from Arab countries, and Iranians from Iran, who came into the country illegally and then successfully sort of disappeared into the broader Muslim community where they cannot be tracked.
Right.
And these essentially pose to us a problem of being sleeper agents. They can perpetrate crimes, they can perpetrate terrorist attacks basically at will when their handlers, their bosses, whatever, tell them to. This is a major issue of national security, and it is not being pursued at any level as far as I know.
Well, you know, it's interesting that you're saying that. You know, one of the things that I do, one of my gigs, so to speak, is to be a member of a speakers bureau known as Allen L. Fried Associates. They do seminars for the federal government, for the intelligence services, the military, law enforcement, and so forth. In fact, just yesterday I was at the Capitol Hill Club, beautiful venue in Washington, right on the outskirts of Capitol Hill. It's the Republican Club. But this is, again, a non-political issue. It's just the place that they generally rent space or acquire space so that we can have our conferences. And I was one of a number of speakers talking about Latin America, and these were high-ranking members of the U.S. military. And one of the questions I always love to ask our military executives, if you will, is why do we still have a military? And before anybody out there gets crazy and says, oh, my God, my cutler's fallen off the edge of the earth, I want to be very clear. First of all, I have nothing but the utmost respect, admiration, you name it. I feel very strongly about being supportive of our men and women in the uniform of all of our military services. This is not to slight them. So let's be very clear and very careful about, because people tend to misquote people, and I want to be very clear about it. But the problem that I have with what we're doing with the military, and by the way, I will tell you that they did come to agree with me. These are people who are generals and colonels and so forth. I said, why do we still have a military when you consider it the military's primary mission, folks, is to keep our enemies as far from our shores as possible? Well, how on earth can they do that with all of the money, with all of the gallantry and the training and the equipment, the nuclear submarines and the aircraft carriers and the stealth bombers? How do you do that when our borders only exist on maps and there are already millions or perhaps tens of millions of illegal aliens in our country? We have no way of knowing who they are, why they're here. We've had the director of the FBI, Robert Mueller, testify numerous times before Congress about his concerns about sleeper agents. I have quoted Mueller myself when I've been on Capitol Hill. The image you're describing is the stuff that keeps me awake at night. In fact, I think it was 2010, the Pentagon issued a report where they talked about how Iranian shock troops, Quds, were being stationed in growing numbers in Venezuela. Of course, Hugo Chavez, there's no love lost between our country and his. There are weekly flights between Tehran and Caracas. We know that there are arms factories that have been built in Venezuela. We know that there are missiles in Venezuela. We know that there are terror training camps in the tri-border region of Brazil, where Brazil borders on Argentina and Paraguay. And we're talking now about Al-Qaeda, Hamas, and Hezbollah, and of course Hezbollah, again, linked to Iran. And we know that Iran has threatened military action against America should even Israel try to take out their nuclear program and realize that we continue to ratchet up economic sanctions. I'm not certain that this will achieve the desired effect. So at some point, Israel or the United States or other countries may well decide that the only viable option is military. And at that point, my great fear is that lots of stuff will start blowing up inside the United States of America. Would you disagree with anything that I've said so far?
That's exactly the problem. When we have 5,000 a year for 10 years is 50,000 potential active terrorists hiding in our population. They're not here because they want jobs or the life for their children. They're here because they want to destroy America. And when the word is given, when the time comes, when whoever is running them, which whether it's Al-Qaeda or Hezbollah or other groups, say to do it, they can do enormous, enormous damage. And the buildup that you've described in Venezuela, which is basically run by Iran, which is, as you said, created a very strong relationship with Hugo Chavez, is creating a situation where there are potentially nuclear-armed missiles in Venezuela that can reach the whole, just every southern state in this country, from California to Florida, from San Diego to Sarasota. And this is, there's nothing that's being done to stop this.
It's remarkable. And, you know, here's the other thing, though. We keep hearing all kinds of funny stuff that understand the problem. President Bush had said, well, if we just let the folks come into the country that want to work, law enforcement can deal with the terrorists. You know, I've been involved with terrorism as well as narcotics investigations during my career as part of the Drug Task Force for 10 years as an immigration agent. And I've worked with the Joint Terrorism Task Force on a number of terrorist investigations. And let me tell you, just about every terrorist that we encounter hides in plain sight by going to a job. And usually it is a job, as we have seen, that provides mobility and camouflage, preferably an ice cream truck, a school bus, as we saw in Toronto, where not only was this character creating a problem for Toronto by wanting to use school kids to create a terror cell, but he was proselytizing and recruiting in the school bus. And think of how commonplace school buses are. You can drive a school bus anywhere and everywhere, and
right,
nobody sees it, just like a taxi cab or a limo or an airport van. And
right,
these were the kinds of jobs where we saw so many terrorists in the past getting employment or working a coffee stand on a street corner or a hot dog stand because, again, they become part of the of the scenery, so to speak. They blend in. People can come up to them. You would expect them to interact with people, whether it's someone buying ice cream or getting in the back of a vehicle to go for a ride, mm-hmm, because the guy's driving a limo. And I can tell you, I've logged thousands of hours doing surveillance. And if somebody gets in a car and drives for 20 minutes and gets out of a car and meets someone in a parking lot or a restaurant or a store, you know there's a meeting. But when someone gets in the back of a taxi or a limo or a van, you don't know if he's just a customer or something clandestine is taking place. And yet these idiotic politicians, our alleged leaders, will say, oh, they're just doing the work Americans don't want to do.
Well,
crazy, isn't it?
It is truly difficult to deal with because, on one hand, some of them are doing exactly that. And whether it's a good thing or a bad thing is a different issue. But they are here. Many, many immigrants, both legal and illegal, are here because they want a better life for themselves and their families. And that's a point that I think too many critics of America don't seem to realize. I mean, we have the immigration situation worldwide is absolutely beyond comprehension.
Yes.
The Institute for Migration Policy issued a study in 2005, which I happen to have in front of me, and they estimated, this is 2005, 7 years ago, that there were 200 million immigrants, both legal and illegal, in the world. And 30% of those, simple math, 60 million, are in the USA and Canada. About 40%, 40 million, are in Europe. Now, this mixes both legal and illegal. So to focus better on our topic, their estimate of illegal immigrants, which, of course, is not necessarily accurate, but it's a ballpark and it's all we have to work with, is that 20% of those 200 million are illegal. In other words, 40 million people. Of those, they think that about half are in the USA and Canada. Half of 40 million is 20 million. Now,
So this is a huge haystack in which some very deadly needles are hiding.
Exactly. That is the whole point. It's a huge haystack. And most of those people are normal, decent people. They want a better life for their kids. They've come to this country or to Canada or in some other countries in Europe like England, France, or Germany who have strong economies. And they want to work and they want to make a new life, and that's great. However, it's the group within that group, the needle in the haystack, that causes problems. And those problems are dire. They're absolutely perilous for each country. And in fact, I mean, you know, we've gotten criticism that America is too strict on immigration or they're too nasty to immigrants. Compared to other countries in Europe, we're like the ideal haven. I mean, just to think about it, this, Switzerland, just 3 years ago,
right,
passed a law prohibiting the construction of any more mosques.
Well,
and they made a law which says that every immigrant, legal or illegal, who is convicted of a crime is deported to his home country. No more mosques, nothing, just they're going to get out. I mean, because the Swiss are overrun with immigrants who, many of them Muslim, are changing the surface, changing the character of the country.
You know, it's remarkable what you're saying. There's a wonderful saying that I remember as a kid, you know, when you're in Rome, do as Romans do. The idea is that if you come to another country, be respectful of their customs and their traditions. And I think a lot of people feel it when they have to make a phone call and suddenly they're told, you know, push one for English or two for Spanish.
Mm-hmm. Right.
We're seeing it in all sorts of things. Now, that's not to say we should not be respectful of the cultures and religions and so forth of those who come to America. But when you come to another country and start to make demands that things be done in a way that accommodates you. You know, we used to be accused of being ugly Americans. We don't even hear that phrase anymore, meaning that we would go to some other country and demand that people spoke Spanish, and they would say, spoke English, rather, and they would say, how dare they? Well, here we have a population of illegal aliens demonstrating on street corners, demanding pathways to citizenship. But although, you know, if you look at that film I was in that Dennis Lynch did, They Come to America, he interviewed some illegal aliens. And they all said that they had no desire to become Americans. They were just here to earn a certain amount of money and go home.
Right.
And go home.
Yes. That's a group. The same study that I was just mentioning a few minutes ago addresses that. There's a large percentage of immigrants, many of them illegal, who are in for seasonal work and then return home, or they're in for a couple of years to make enough money to buy a house and their home, and then they go home. Now, as long as they're honest people who work hard, pay their taxes, and obey the law, that's not a problem. However, a growing percentage of these folks are not. And this is where the danger that we're ignoring exists for American society and ultimately the USA. You know, we're not taking the steps that other countries are taking. The other countries, I mentioned Switzerland, Australia is an excellent example. Australia has been plagued with an enormous wave of illegal immigrants, and the majority, the overwhelming majority, are Muslim. They're from East Asian countries primarily. And what Australia did was created a new law, which has been criticized by various NGOs and human rights programs, but they're standing by it, which says if you are caught here without a visa, you go into defined detention. You just go to jail, and then we'll see what we want to do with you. That's Australia.
Well, you know, what's remarkable, the United States provides more green cards, more lawful immigrant status more people than the rest of the countries of the world combined, more than 1.1 million. And, you know, you raised a very interesting point. And, you know, you and I are both Jewish. My family suffered during the Holocaust. I believe your family suffered as well. This idea of political asylum, you know, we are all very sensitive to the idea of the asylee whose lives are threatened in their home countries. But unfortunately, we know that terrorists have used political asylum as a ploy to enter our country and then abscond. There was a guy by the name of Amir Khanzi, who in 1993, from Pakistan, acquired political asylum by lying on his application and then repaid America's generosity and, frankly, incompetence once he got political asylum by standing outside CIA headquarters with an AK-47. He opened fire, killed two CIA officers, wounded three others, and then fled the country because these folks have a trapdoor they can escape through, just like transnational gangs. So he fled, but because of the nature of the crime, our guys hunted him down, dragged him back to the United States, where he was put on trial, found guilty, executed, but the people he killed remained dead. But you would think after Khanzi that a message would have been sent, that a lesson would have been learned. And in fact, the Khanzi case, and a month later, the first attack on the World Trade Center, where again we had aliens who came here from the Middle East, who gamed the amnesty of 86, Mahmoud Abu Alima, claimed to be an agricultural worker. The only thing he ever planted was a bomb in the garage of the Trade Center. So these guys had all gamed the visa process and then the immigration benefits program as an embedding tactic. So I was asked by Lamar Smith, and in those days it was Henry Hyde who chaired the House Judiciary Committee, to testify at a hearing that focused on visa fraud and immigration benefit fraud. So clearly, there were members of Congress who understood the danger. Meanwhile, we see a case of a guy by the name of Abraham Fazhazian, who just 2 years ago, according to ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, was granted political asylum from Eritrea because he claimed that his life was in danger. And then they were bragging about how, although he claimed he was guilty, he was a danger because of threats to his life. In reality, he was not in Eritrea when he claimed to be running for his life, but he was in Guatemala smuggling aliens from parts of Africa associated with terrorism and extremist groups into the United States. Now, what startled me, David, this is what I can't comprehend, and I wish the American people would really pay attention to this stuff. It might not be as exciting as Dancing with the Stars or which team is going to win the next baseball game, but it's about the survival of our country and the safety of our citizens. Fazhazian was found guilty of alien smuggling at the time that he had been granted political asylum. It took them all of, I think it was 3 weeks, to approve his application for political asylum. And they bragged on their website, and I wrote a commentary about it for capsweb.org and my own website, michaelcutler.net. They bragged about how they got this guy. Well, I'll tell you what they didn't talk about. They did not talk about any efforts made to locate, arrest, or apprehend, or deport the aliens he smuggled into the United States. And there wasn't a single word in that press release about any efforts to strip this guy of political asylum and prosecuting him for lying, because it was clear he really was not someone who should have been given political asylum. He wasn't in Eritrea at the time he was purportedly running for his life. And this isn't just an academic argument. Because he has political asylum when he gets out of jail, which will probably only be a year or two from now, he will be allowed to remain in the United States. This is a guy who should be removed from the United States. But once you get political asylum, unless you are stripped of asylum, we allow you to remain here forever. So I don't understand how on earth we can pursue a war on terror and a war on crime and not go after the people who have demonstrated that they are a significant, clear, and present danger to national security and the safety of Americans.
Well, I will give you an answer, which I'm sure many listeners might not like, but part of the problem has been the complicity of the presidency in the problem. Obama is a very good example now, but it goes back before him. It goes back to Clinton and to Bush, and both Bushes, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And
Ronald Reagan with the amnesty of 86,
and
Jimmy Carter with declaring we couldn't call illegal aliens because they needed
anymore
to be counted in the census.
Right.
Yep.
Now, why the office of the presidency has been compromised in this way by this issue is not clear. But the actions of presidents, as you pointed out, from Carter onward, and especially most recently with Obama and the DREAM Act, have been actions that seem to seek to support the apparatus that allows these things to happen. There isn't an analysis to say, oh, here's a weak spot. These guys didn't know that he wasn't in Eritrea when they found out. No, none of that happened. The internal analysis doesn't take place, but rather broad strokes, which seem to have a humanitarian motivation to them, but which inherently create greater ease for people who really are dangerous to our society to enter our society. Doesn't make sense, but it goes up to the office of the presidency.
Well, you know, there's the Chamber of Commerce. I call them the Chamber of Horrors. And you know, this is something that blows my mind. You know, I'm a lifelong registered Democrat. I am not, by anyone's definition, a conservative. People like to say, oh, you're a conservative. But in point of fact, on most issues, you'd accuse me of being fairly liberal. I'm an American. I'm a centrist, really. But the Chamber of Commerce has a track record of being in favor of big business and working against government where it interferes with enterprise. And in fact, it's remarkable to me, because there was a film about Ralph Nader, and whether you love him or hate him, he was an incredible, or is an incredible guy. I have issues with his running for president and some of the stuff that he does, but certainly I think this guy has done amazing work in his lifetime. And one of the biggest enemies he acquired along the way was the Chamber of Commerce. And of course, the liberals love Ralph Nader. He's the muckraker, the guy that's out there, you know, beating up on the big guys, David and Goliath, and he's certainly David. And the Chamber of Commerce has created something that most people don't know about. It is called the Discover America Partnership. And what they've done is to create this organization. They have brought in with them, in bed with them, and believe me, this is really a form of prostitution in my judgment, the travel industry, the hotel industry, the hospitality industries, the tourism industries. They've now added manufacturers, the guys that make the trinkets. And the argument that they pose, and I've testified with them at congressional hearings, most recently January of last year, and they don't like borders. They want everybody to come here because they want to fill every seat on every airplane. They want to get every bed slept on in every hotel. I had a friend at the Immigration Subcommittee a couple of years ago say to me that the goal of the hotels and the travel industry and the Chamber of Commerce is to have illegal aliens change the sheets in the hotels and have the wealthy tourists from foreign countries sleep on those sheets. So they're doing well. It's a great way of describing it.
Absolutely.
And definitely, what they have done is to create the Discover America Partnership. And they're saying, they're kind of like the barker at the carnival, you know, the guy with the megaphone and the straw hat.
True.
Come
mm-hmm.
up, step right up, folks. See what we've got here, you know, the five-legged man or God knows what attraction.
Yeah,
and
right.
So they want everyone here. And they are spending almost limitless money on political campaigns to extend the visa waiver country to ever more countries. And here's something to think about. Richard Reed, the shoe bomber, is the reason we have to take our shoes off before we can get on an airplane. In fact, I do a lot of traveling by plane. I have a couple of preferred pairs of loafers that I use because I don't like being bothered to have to sit down and tie up my shoes. I just want to grab my stuff and head to the gate after I go through security.
Right.
Reed is the reason. So our government, brilliant as it is, could figure it out. You can put bombs in your shoes. Bombs in your underwear. I'm still waiting for the TSA wedgie that can't be far behind. Goodness gracious. But, you know, on top of it, though, we know that bombs can be concealed in all sorts of things and the danger of cutting devices. So we go through this incredible inspection process because of Reed and others. But the fact that he could get on that airplane in the first place without getting a visa because he's a citizen of Great Britain, the fact that Massawi, the so-called 20th hijacker, citizen of France, did not need a visa either. We know this. But the government's reaction to that part of the equation is that while there were 27 visa waiver countries when Reid got on that airplane just weeks after 9/11,
yeah.
Guess what, folks? Now, today we have 36 visa waiver countries.
Yeah.
And recently Obama, in January, went to Disneyland, or Disney World in Florida, I confused the two, saying that we need to streamline the visa process for visitors from China, and we need to make it far easier for citizens from Brazil to come to the United States. I don't want to single out Brazilians, but think back to what we said at the beginning of the program. Brazil is where we have terror training camps.
Absolutely, the tri-border region.
So here you have the President of the United States saying, you know what? We need to expand the visa waiver program, and we need to simplify the visa process. The 9/11 Commission, by the way, to which I provided testimony, identified Visa Express, the ease with which the terrorists got visas so they could come to America to attack us, was a source of major vulnerability. And now we have the President of the United States calling for, he didn't say Visa Express, but making it much easier for people from Brazil to get visas to come here.
Right.
I mean, tell me this doesn't stop you dead in your tracks.
Well, let me just add something to that, which goes back to the same research that I mentioned a few minutes ago from the Migration Policy Institute. Brazil, speaking of Brazil, is a very totally amazing country. I mean, it's an economic force which has, I think, has recently been declared that it was the sixth largest economy in the world as of the beginning of this year, 2012. Therefore, it became very quickly an immigration magnet, and especially an illegal immigration magnet, because Brazil didn't have much in the way of law enforcement set up to handle that, because there was never a problem until Brazil became so economically successful. So now what Brazil has begun to do is crack down. But the problem is we now have somewhere around 30,000 illegal immigrants in Brazil who have made their way to the tri-border region, which is very mountainous, and it's within an area which is largely jungle. And as a result, the government has very little control. The local police are limited in their power and, according to the resources I've read, are corrupt. And the forces which have been established there, primarily Hezbollah, Al-Qaeda, and Hamas, have plenty of money with which to bribe people and to do what Hamas does very well, which is create social services, food centers, little hospitals or clinics where everybody can come and be treated for free. And then the people locally don't want to, provide the government with information about the people who have come in illegally. So Brazil is left literally bereft. It has no way to deal with these people who are literally creating terrorist training camps in the tri-border region, sending the people north through Venezuela to Mexico and then into the USA. So making the Brazilian visa requirements easier simply invites those same terrorists to come in legally. It's crazy.
Well, it is absolutely crazy. And meanwhile, if you look at the way that we've been witnessing a constant erosion of our expectations of privacy and freedom in the United States, and you know, last week, last Friday, CBS Radio reported on something that blew my mind. Apparently, the president, and I was speaking to one of these military leaders yesterday about it, who confirmed it and said that it was causing him consternation. The president signed an executive order. Here we go again. We don't need those stinking checks and balances.
Right.
And what was it that he said? I, as president, will have the authority, if I declare an emergency, to shut down the internet and the telephone network. Now, if that doesn't give us all great cause for pause, who is going to be the arbiter who's going to say, yep, this is an emergency?
Right.
Is there anything in the Constitution that says freedom of speech can be abridged? I mean, we know, for example, that when you're in the military, or if you're working, and I worked in issues involving national security, you can't go home and say to your wife, guess what I did today, honey, and then tell her about national security stuff.
Right.
There was a time before I met my current wife when I was dating a young lady who was an FBI agent, and she worked on counterterrorism, counterespionage.
Mm-hmm.
And there were days I was up at DEA intelligence. She was working on spies. And, you know, it would be an interesting conversation over dinner. How was your day at work? Oh, it was interesting. How was yours? Oh, my day was interesting, too. Great. Is it going to rain this weekend? Because we couldn't talk about it. So
couldn't
certainly
talk about it, right.
It's certainly true that there are times when the government can abridge what you can talk about when you're working on that sort of thing. But to go across the board and say, we're going to shut down Americans' ability to communicate with one another, period, simply
mm-hmm.
because we declare an emergency, I got to tell you, this is the kind of thing, and I'm not one of these black helicopter kind of characters. You know me, David.
Mm-hmm.
But this sort of thing is so disturbing. I don't even know where to begin with it, to be honest with you.
Well, what I find, I completely agree, but even more disturbing for me is the fact that this particular activity has completely gone beneath the radar of our media and therefore beneath the knowledge of our population. And no one has sat down at CNN or CBS or Fox and said, gee, what are the dangers inherent in this declaration? How could it be misused? What does this imply regarding future plans that the president has?
Well, that's a great point. You know, CBS, to their credit, and I very often have a problem with the way they cover the news, but CBS Radio yesterday, 880 here in New York, did cover it, or covered it a couple days ago, and the announcer said that what was troubling was that there was nothing in the executive order that will take effect, I believe, in 30 days, that laid out the criteria that would precipitate the declaration of an emergency.
Precisely.
And that was the only time I heard it on the radio. I haven't heard it since.
Mm-hmm.
And I just happened to be listening at the right time. I have my shower radio, you know, so when I'm scrubbing up, if I'm going somewhere, I know what whether the traffic is going to be, and I put that on and so that I know what's going on. And just by happenstance, I happened to catch that one report. I have not heard it or seen it anywhere else.
Since. Right. Okay. Well, that's one more than I heard, and that really hammers home the real problem. It's not being addressed. There is no... as you said before, checks and balances. Is anybody in Congress speaking out against this? Did somebody in the Supreme Court say, gee, that doesn't make a lot of sense. I think we better check into that. What's going on here?
Well, what's going on, you know, my dad had a wonderful expression. He used to say to me that ultimately I would be the person who would teach those people that I interacted with how they could treat me by demonstrating what I was willing to tolerate and accept. The average American does not get involved with his own government. They had an episode on TV a couple of days ago. I think Fox did this, but it was kind of like the jaywalking routine, where they asked these people in their 20s at the beach, I believe was the venue, who it was that we got our independence from. This was shortly after July 4th. From what country did we get our independence? And they were laughing their tails off because they had no idea. I have seen similar episodes where they've asked people, who did we fight during the Second World War? They had no idea. Somebody said Russia, somebody said China. They had no idea that the enemy was Japan and Germany. They were clueless, absolutely, utterly, completely clueless. So when you have Americans who will tell you what the batting average of their favorite hitter is on whatever team, well, they will tell you who's winning Dancing with the Stars. But if you say to them, name one Supreme Court justice, name one member of the cabinet of the President of the United States, who did we win our independence from? And they look at you as though you were speaking a foreign language. You have to understand what happens. The American people have made it abundantly clear to their supposed representatives that we are a nation of idiots. H.L. Mencken had a wonderful quote. He said that nobody ever lost money underestimating the intelligence of the average American, kind of echoing what P.T. Barnum said about a sucker being born every minute.
Right.
And Mencken wasn't wrong. I mean, was this not the country where they not only were able to successfully market and sell the Pet Rock, but a year later made even more money with the training manual for the Pet Rock?
I remember that.
I mean, what does that say about the intelligence of the average American? So you look at that stupidity in action. You look at the average American who doesn't vote, and now you're talking about a big population, and then it really gets big when you say to people, when was the last time you wrote a letter or made a phone call to anybody on any level of government to complain or comment about an issue that concerned you?
Mm-hmm.
We don't go to restaurants and to get into our little time machine, if you will, and think back to Johnny Carson. We don't play Mighty Karnak with the waiter in the restaurant. We don't slap the menu to our forehead and say to the guy, guess what I want? You know, we're very specific. I want a cheeseburger, and I want it with Swiss cheese, and I want it medium well. I don't want it rare, and if they don't make it the way you want, we send it back, and if that doesn't work, we leave. But most Americans don't say a word, and most Americans don't even want to know about it. You know, you and I talked about this. You know, that line from the treasure of Sierra Madre, badges, we don't need no stinking badges. For Americans, it's the truth. We don't need no stinking truth. I've offered to go to certain places and do a presentation to explain not why I oppose immigration, which is how the other side labels you immediately, but why immigration needs to be dealt with as a matter of nothing less than national security. And you would think people would be happy to have an opportunity to have an educated debate, discussion, disagree with me. Tell me I'm a blithering idiot. I don't mind. I mean, you better be able to back it up, I would hope. But, you know, I don't mind the discourse or the debate. I was on the debating teams in high school and college, and I love debate. It's a place where you learn how to articulate your ideas and really get to challenge your own thoughts, thoughts as well as your opponents. And many times I am told, well, your position opposes where we are, so don't come here.
Yes.
You know, the founding fathers said that we have the right to peaceably assemble. It's right in the First Amendment. It's not just about freedom of speech, press, and religion. It's about the right for peaceable assemblage.
That's
why?
Right.
Because they understood you need debate, discourse, perhaps even argument, as long as it's done peacefully so that you can truly practice democracy. How do you practice democracy, David? You're the professor. How do you practice democracy without discourse, debate, or discussion?
Well, it is inimical to democracy to repress freedom of speech. And one of the great ironies that our society faces, and which people really aren't talking about that much, and is serious a problem, is that there's been a shift in our society. What we refer to sometimes as the left wing or the liberal has become very illiberal in terms of freedom of speech for those whose opinions are different from the liberal opinions. I've experienced this personally in debates when I've been at universities and in classrooms that I taught, where the idea is, if you don't agree with me, then you really have no place in the discussion. Well, what are we discussing then if I don't agree with you but you don't want to hear it? There's a sense of, in fact, I've used this term with you before, there's a sense of ideology trumping facts. I have my belief. I don't want it challenged. I don't want to hear opinions that conflict with mine. I just have my belief. And
Don't confuse me with the facts.
That's right. My mind is made up. Don't confuse me with facts. That's exactly correct. And this has become, I don't want to say the norm. I don't do that much speaking outside, and I can't really talk about, you know, hundreds of events, but certainly it's the norm in a fair number of events that I've taken part in, where the other side simply doesn't want to hear any debate. That's the opposite of a free society where speech and thought and opinion are accepted as free.
Well, you know, here's the question. In fact, I just got a question emailed to me. So what does the average person do? What on earth do we do? And I go out there and do my stuff with, whether it's this program or talkborder.com or writing for capsweb.org, or I go on Fox News or whatever, or go before Congress. And I think what I do is a little bit unusual, but I get to do it because I was an agent. But what is the average American, the guy who comes home and maybe like my dad is a construction worker or is a school teacher or maybe works in a factory, and they're looking at the situation and they're saying, this stinks. So, What are your ideas? Because I know where I believe, but I'm curious, as the professor that you are, the guy who helped to mold minds, which was your profession as a teacher, as an educator.
Right.
What do we do? What do we tell people when they say, what can I do?
Okay. I will be happy to answer that question. Listeners, get your pencil and paper out. Here's a list. All right? Number one, get educated yourself. That's the first thing. It's not enough to simply feel that this stinks. You have to be able to say what it is that stinks, and let's look for why. And the way you do that is by reading not just your local paper, but also internet magazines, international newspapers. I, for example, love to read French and British newspapers that you can get online, and the French ones are translated, and understand that there are other things out there happening, and people perceive things ways differently than we do. Get educated. Number two, when you see something in a newspaper which you know doesn't make sense or is really wrong, write about it. Send a letter to the editor. Be polite and stick to facts. Do not rant. Do not call names, but simply say why this is wrong. Editors of newspapers respond. If they get one letter, they might not notice it too much. If they get five, they'll print one. And it's important to get your voice out there and to let people know, especially let newspapers know, that you're not happy with the way they're covering something, a one-sided article, a clearly politicized editorial. Your voice counts. Number three, support the institutions that make it their job to address these issues. So depending on what the issue is, there are a host of not-for-profit organizations. Act for America, for example, or the David Horowitz Freedom Center and Front Page Magazine.
Now, we could talk about CAPS also, Californians for Population
Stabilization. That's an excellent example. Yeah. Support them. Send them money and tell them why you're supporting them. Write a letter and get on their mailing list. Get their emails. That'll allow you to get educated more easily into these problems. Now, the fourth thing to do, which is the hardest, is to get physically involved yourself. And this might mean phone call, email, fax, or handwritten letter. Very impressive. Handwritten letters are very impressive. They get read. Handwritten letter to your congresspersons. Check their voting record. How have they voted on immigration issues? How have they voted on national defense issues? And let them know what you think.
I'll add something to that also, David. Attend town hall meetings with your elected representative.
Excellent idea. Certainly add that to it. I guess that's part of number four. That's really a good point.
But, yes, that's why I was thinking about that. But I think it's really important. Try to pin the guy down. And
right.
Don't get up there name-calling. Don't get up there strident and screaming.
Right.
And try to have a focused question. And if you can, if you get that opportunity, the follow-up. Because the follow-up is really where you could stick a knife in someone's heart. But the idea is go there with a – don't just say, what are you going to do about immigration? And the guy says, build a fence. And you're done.
Right. Right.
You have to say to the guy is, okay, we know that we're bringing in lots of people to do the high-tech jobs, the H-1B visas. What is your plan to see to it that more Americans rather than foreign workers get those jobs? How do we eliminate this business of importing foreign high-tech workers? That's the kind of narrow, specific question where the guy can't run anywhere.
That's right. You have to be focused in your answer when you're faced with a focused question. And if you're not focused in your answer, then you have revealed your own ignorance, weakness, or unwillingness to discuss.
I had the delight when Newt Gingrich was running for the presidency, and I was given the distinct privilege of addressing the Tea Party convention. And this is another thing, folks, it's my pet peeve. Everybody's vilifying everyone. The Democrats are idiots. The Republicans are fools. The Tea Party is crazy. Folks, we're Americans. I would rather see occupiers and Tea Partiers, as long as they don't get violent or do crazy stuff, out
right.
there protesting what they're angry about, because they're doing more than the average schmo sitting in his living room eating popcorn and watching a baseball game.
Right.
So let's have respect for Americans who are practitioners of the First Amendment.
Right.
But, you know, so the Tea Party asked me to speak, and I did. And I spoke right after Newt Gingrich. But I encountered Newt at the bar that night, and I approached him and said, Mr. Speaker, I have a fast question. And there were a lot of people listening.
Mm-hmm.
And he knew who I was. And I said, with all the talk about creating jobs, why aren't you talking about the need to liberate jobs by enforcing immigration law? It takes a long time to create jobs and takes lots of money. You got to build buildings and so forth. Enforcing immigration laws, let me tell you, as the agents are taking the illegals out the back door, American workers and lawful immigrants of every race, religion, and ethnicity could be coming through the front door the same day and taking those jobs that they are desperate to get so they can support themselves and their families. Why aren't you talking about that? And this glib, articulate, I don't want to say master debater, because someone's going to say something about that. But here's this guy that has this reputation for being an amazing debater, stood there looking for all the world like the proverbial deer stuck in the headlight of an oncoming car. And I had a number of people come up to me afterwards and say, wow, that really quieted him.
Good.
But that's the example of a focused. Don't say to him, do you want to see the immigration laws enforced? The guy's going to say, absolutely. What does it mean? What does that really mean?
Absolutely. Well, that actually brings me to number five, the last thing, which you, I think, have said it better than I could. People should get involved on a personal level with those organizations that are related to the issues that they find important. You send money, you get on their mailing list, but then you can volunteer. You can listen. You can go to meetings. You listen to speakers. You can take part in the debates. Getting involved personally is very important because it lends bodies, it lends real people to the debate, and that's extremely important.
No, I agree.
If listeners, if you got the 5 points, get to work.
You've got your homework, and the teacher has just spoken.
Yeah, listen,
by the way, you know I have to ask you the spelling count.
Have to ask you what?
The spelling count.
Oh, actually, I'm glad you asked that. Yes, people tend to pay attention to effective writing.
You bet.
Effective writing is not just coherent articulation of ideas, but it's also correct articulation of ideas. So good grammar and good spelling. You know, you write it on the, you spell check, and it's not so difficult.
Although you'd be amazed at how sometimes we're not careful. Spell check gives us whole new meanings to what we write.
Yes, that happens. But you still got to review it, right? You got to read it yourself too.
Sure. No, I'm teasing with you. But you know what you're saying is true. You know, there was they used to do ads in New York. I don't know if you ever remember hearing it, but they always used to say, "People judge you by the words you use."
Oh yeah.
And that is such an important concept. It's about being credible. I mean, you can feel anger all you want, but when you come up with stuff that really sounds vitriolic and accusatory, I think you lose credibility. It's got to be focused. It should be relatively short. You know, some people, when I do events where I ask a question, instead of asking a question, people get up and start making a long-winded speech, and they're told to sit down. Don't blow an opportunity by making a speech. Come in there with a focused question, or as you're listening, bring a notepad and scratch out a question, because let's say the president talks about we have to help the children, and he's talking about the DREAM Act, and we know that this isn't about kids because the maximum age is age 30. If there's a follow-up question, then that's the perfect time to stand up and say, Mr. President, you said this is all about the children. But in point of fact, what you're doing would allow aliens up to their 30th birthday to participate. Do you believe a 30-year-old is a child?
That's a good direct question.
That's the kind of question that cuts to the quick.
Yes.
Do you believe? You say that the Congress didn't act, Mr. President, but didn't they act to vote down this legislation on a number of times? Isn't voting nay as valid as voting yay, and perhaps more important? I mean, doctors take a Hippocratic oath that says, first do no harm. Were they not living up to that standard, Mr. President?
Yeah.
Now, imagine you confront the president with that kind of a question. I guarantee you will make the evening news, and probably not just in your little hometown, but probably across America. Think of that reporter in the Rose Garden who said to the president on June 15th, what about American workers, Mr. President? Boy, was that a focused question or what? And that made headlines around the world.
Right.
What about the American workers?
That's right. And the president's response was, It's not time for questions, sir.
Especially one that I have no intention of answering.
That's right. No intention.
And sometimes it's like that, like that game goes, it's not what you say that counts, but what you don't say.
Don't say, right.
But this is where we, the people, have to have our voices heard. Don't carry on like a loon, because then, and you know, that's what the news media loves. They love to get some guy who sounds like Archie Bunker, who starts screaming at a politician, "I want them people out of my neighborhood." That's the kind of thing that does more harm than you could ever imagine, because now we know who that guy is. He's a lout, he's a bigot, and so forth. So what we really want is a reasoned discussion. If you see a flaw in a politician's argument and there is a town hall forum, that's the opportunity. As I pointed out with this age business, you're talking about children, yet the age cutoff is 30. How do you respond to that?
Right.
And let me tell you, when this guy starts to vibrate and dances around it, he's given you the answer you want. This is like testifying in court. If you can't answer the question, the fact that you don't answer it speaks volumes.
That's exactly right. Yes, that's the point about if the person doesn't give you a direct answer, you know that he can't answer your question. He doesn't want to answer your question. Yeah, I happen to have the transcript of that Rose Garden speech, which you were referring to a few seconds ago, and it's really quite amazing. Well, after his fairly concise speech, he talked about the Dream Act and how wonderful it is for all these people who can make real contributions to come to America. Somebody in the audience, you mentioned he was a reporter, began to try to question him, and the president cut him off. "Excuse me, sir, it's not time for questions." "No, no, you have to take questions. We have questions." "No, no, not while I'm speaking." "Oh, okay." Then he tries again, and the president says, "I didn't ask for an argument. I don't argue with you, but President, I'd like to." No. And then he simply wouldn't allow the person to ask the question. That's a very important sign. That means that that question, whatever it may have been, but it was apparently about the issue of American workers who are unemployed because foreigners have taken the jobs, is a question that the president doesn't want to address.
Remarkable in listening to CBS today, Dave. They were talking about how both Obama and the Romney camps are lobbing grenades at each other.
Right.
What are they lobbing grenades about? Who has done more to send jobs overseas? Now, this is astonishing to me, and we talked about this off-air earlier today. The issue of outsourcing jobs, sending jobs overseas, is very simple. It's a very easy concept. This is about depriving Americans the opportunity to do the jobs. That's why it is so repugnant. You send a job overseas, that's a job that will not be done by an American, because the likelihood is that we are not going to send Americans overseas to chase the job.
Right.
Well, as bad as that is, and it is bad, why does nobody connect the idea that by bringing in foreign workers, whether it's the illegals who do the backbreaking, filthy, scut-level work, or the aliens who come in committing visa fraud to do the H-1B or other high-tech jobs, in either case, what we are doing is creating unfair competition against the American worker who can't get the job. And when the president said on that day, June 15th, and we were just going over the transcript, he said 800,000 such aliens would qualify, and the Pew Hispanic Center, which always underestimates numbers, actually differed with the president and pegged it at 1.4 million, nearly twice what the president claimed. And I got to tell you, that 1.4 million resonates with me. You know why? Because in 1986, when I was an INS agent and the administration was trying to sell what they called back then the Immigration Reform and Control Act, IRCA, as it was called, the amnesty bill, we were told about 1 million to 1.5 million aliens. So they rounded it off and said, well, around 1.25, 1.3, 1.4 million would be involved, kind of like what the Pew Hispanic Center said.
Right.
And then we wound up with nearly 4 million. So I would contend that we will probably see the same sort of thing here. So while the news media is fixated on BLS, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, announcements every month about how many jobs were created, and they get all excited, wow, they created 150,000 jobs last month, and no one talks about whether it's part-time or minimum wage or just seasonal jobs that will evaporate after Christmas is over or after, you know, the summer vacation is over. They don't discuss that. They just talk about how many jobs were created. And we also know that the administration tends to cook the books. They give one set of numbers, and 2 days later they go, oh, you know, we made a mistake. And then, of course, the retraction appears on page 15, whereas the original statistic that was a higher number appears on the front page, and no one ever pays a price for this duplicitous conduct. But while they fixate on those numbers, nobody is standing up and saying, wait a moment, if you give 1 million or 2 million or 3 million illegal aliens employment authorization, legally, they have as much entitlement to jobs in the United States as an American or a lawful resident.
Right.
So now suddenly, I compare this to a game of musical chairs where the president has just thrown the door open and let lots more kids into the room, but they didn't provide them with any more chairs to sit on. They didn't provide those workers with any more jobs that they can vie for. And, you know, when actors or actresses, I've never done this, but I have friends who have done this, go to a casting call, or if you go on a job interview and you're sitting in the waiting room, and this I did do when I was trying to become an agent, and you sit around and you see all these other people sitting there in their suits and their spit-shine shoes. Well, these are all competitors. And the more people in that room, the more the odds are against your getting that job or getting that promotion. So you don't want lots of people in that room. You'd love to know, well, it's just me or him, and hopefully I'm more qualified, right? But when there's 800 people in the room for five jobs, you say, wow, the odds aren't good. Well, think of what the president just did. He filled that room with perhaps a couple of million prospective workers, and yet nobody in the news media talks about that, but they do focus on the Bureau of Labor Statistics.
It's a conundrum.
Why is there such a disconnect? Do you find this a difficult argument to I can't imagine that this is difficult for you to come to the same conclusion that I have. So why do our fellow Americans not get it?
Well, let's go back to what I said before about ideology trumps facts. Okay, so we have a humanistic, humanitarian, good-hearted, well-meaning society. And we want to help the poor people, and they are poor people, who are living in adverse conditions in other countries. So why not be generous? But wait, no one points out what it's going to cost us to be generous. And we could decide as a society through elections of politicians who suggest this, that indeed, even though it will cost us jobs and it will hurt our financial situation and it will undermine our economy, we still want to be generous because those are good people out there who could work with us. However, when you don't have that knowledge and you can't make that decision, then you've gotten a situation where it's being decided for you, but you're going to pay the consequences. And that's not right.
But isn't this so remarkable? And this issue of vilification. You know, when I talk about how we're exploiting aliens, it's funny, the liberals get all upset when they see schoolyard bullies. These are workplace bullies. This is about exploiting people. This is the equivalent of saying that if you didn't want to own a slave during that dark era of American history when slavery was considered business as usual for so many parts of our country, this would be the equivalent of saying, well, if you didn't want to own a slave, then you probably didn't like black people.
Right.
I mean, think how insane this is.
But you see, now there's a different issue. What you've raised now is very important, but it's different from what I just said. See, when you want to get people to go along with you and to support your whatever it is, your issue, your initiative, your idea, and you know that there are negative aspects that are going to impact on those people whom you're trying to get to support you, you don't want them to know about those negative aspects, so you find other things to say.
Mm-hmm.
And the other things that you need to say are things that will be impactful, that will generate a visceral response. Oh my God, no, we're not racist. Of course we should be doing that. Well, something with racism, it's economics. It doesn't matter what color people's skins are. What matters is can they do the work or not. So So if you leave it in those terms, then people will say, no, I don't want to have my brother-in-law out of work because we have this generous policy. If you don't put it in those terms, but you put it in terms that you know the gentleman will respond to positively, then you get your way. That's the issue here. We have people who are presenting the issues in a way which makes us feel that we're not going to pay a cost, a price. We're not going to pay a price. But we do have a huge price to pay. It's deceitful for our government, especially our president. It's not just our current president. It's across...
No, it's been a succession of presidents, and it's both sides of the aisle. And
right.
So now we get to the final part of this, at least for this evening, and I know we're running a little bit long, but I'm so glad you're staying with me. I hope that my listeners are staying with me. And this
right.
comes down to campaign finance. You
yeah.
know, I was a federal employee for 30 years. I'm very proud of it. But I was not allowed to accept so much as a cup of coffee when I was on duty because the concern was that somehow people would think they owned you or that you had a special relationship. Well,
mm-hmm.
that's over the cost of a cup of coffee. Could you imagine if I had gone to my bosses and said, be proud of me, I'm the best fundraiser? But isn't that exactly what every politician on every level of government brags about? They are out there shamelessly with a cup saying, give me money. Now, I understand why they have to do it, but the point is that by doing that, then they are creating the kind of problem that would have been unacceptable in law enforcement or for other government agencies, and that being too cozy a relationship between the politicians, the government officials,
mm-hmm.
and the people
right.
governed.
Right. That is exactly and absolutely correct. It is a tremendous conundrum. And it goes along with the well-known problem that what does a politician do as soon as he gets elected? His main focus is going to be working on re-election.
Yep.
Now, does that leave him a whole lot of time to handle the things he's been elected to handle? That's a conundrum in our government, and it's a real problem. And people are seduced into it, even the best union people.
They are, and you know, once they get that taste of power, then the goal is to maintain that power.
That's right.
There is. I am working on something, and I'm going to have to be very, mysterious about this, but we should know within the next couple of days.
Mm-hmm.
I have come up with evidence of a real bad situation where the barrier between law enforcement and the public has been taken down.
Wow.
You know, I used to have a boss who had a wonderful expression. His name was Frank Johnson. He was the chief of investigations when I was a young agent. And he was one of those guys. He reminded me of Peter Jennings. He was originally from Canada. He would smoke cigarettes. He was the kind of guy who came to work earlier than he signed in. He would eat lunch at his desk. He lived by stricter rules for himself than for anybody else. So you
mm-hmm.
could never go to him and say, why are you bothering me? You're worse than I am. No, he wasn't. He would be at his desk at 8:15 and sign in at 8:30. He would work until 5:30 and sign off at 5. He would take 15 minutes for lunch when he was entitled to 45 minutes to an hour. I remember one day he was deathly ill. He was running a high fever and asked me if I had driven to work in my own car. Because if I did, he said, in your own car, if you could drive me to the train station, which in those days was at the World Trade Center, I would appreciate it. It was raining out. It was a cold, wintry night. If it had been 2 degrees colder instead of rain, we would have had snow. And I offered to drive him home. He said, how would I account for your time? Because I live an hour and a half from here. That would mean that for 3 hours, you'd be not working, but helping me out. He said, the only way we could justify that is if you would be willing to give me some of your annual leave, and I won't ask you for that. That's the kind of guy he was. I did drive him to the train in my own car, though. And he said, by the way, if you don't have your own car here, I'm off duty, and when you're off duty, you're not allowed in a government car.
Right.
So this was the guy who – and he would always end meetings with the troops by saying, folks, never forget that we are federal agents. As a federal agent, it is not enough that you don't engage in wrongdoing. You must never even give the illusion of doing wrong.
Right.
Imagine if our leaders today adhered to Frank Johnson's standard of conduct and ethics.
Yeah, quite a different picture.
Well, he was one of my mentors, And I understand, tragically, he died. I can't say tragically. He was probably in his 80s, but it's still a tragedy when a good human being passes on. But he was a guy I had stayed in touch with over the years, and then we kind of lost touch over the last several. But this was a guy who really was a mentor, who really demanded professionalism, who understood human nature and would let the guys have a BS session at you know, whatever point, didn't get out there ranting and raving. I remember one day we were discussing an investigation I was working on. He reminds me of the character in All the President's Men. I can't think the name of the editor of the Washington Post that Jason Robards played, but it will come to me. But that character reminded me so much of Frank Johnston. We were having this meeting about a major case I was working on, and he noticed that everybody on a Friday afternoon was kind of standing around, and the noise of the conversation was filling the office. And he looked at his watch and he said, "Well, human nature," he said, "I guess you guys need to have time to blow off some steam." He said, "Mike, can you keep track of the time? Let me know when 15 minutes has passed." And I said, "Okay." And we sat there working on the case for 15 minutes, going over strategies and who we were going to arrest and who we might want to have indicted and so forth. And I looked down at my watch and realized that about 20 minutes had passed, and I said, "Mr. Johnston," and I would never have dreamed of calling him Frank while I worked for him as a matter of respect. Mm-hmm. And I said, "Mr. Johnston, it's 15 minutes, 20 minutes, whatever." And he walked out of his office, put his hands on his hips, and just coughed, cleared his throat, cleared his throat. And everyone just kind of looked up at him. No one said a word. They all waved at him. He waved back. And everybody broke up their little BS session and went back to their desks and got back to work. Uh-huh. That, to me, was the best example of leadership. It wasn't about bluff and bluster and threatening and screaming. It was simply a matter of standing out there with his hands on his hips, giving a little cough, and then clearing his throat rather loudly. And everyone just looked up and knew exactly what he was saying. And that was the end of it. And that, to me, is what leadership should be about. Maintain the standards, don't be hypocritical, and be fair about the way you deal with people.
Yeah, lead by example, too.
Oh, and this guy was the example. And so when I look at the stuff that's going on, and what I think will be some interesting news coming next week one way or the other, and I will tell you I am privileged to be working with a member of Congress for whom I have tremendous respect, one of the few true leaders in the House of Representatives. We really need to make our government accountable, folks. This concept of government by the people is more than words. More than words. If it's truly a government by the people and for the people and of the people, that makes us the employers. The most important title in our government is citizen, folks. We have forgotten that. And by forgetting it, we are allowing the politicians to conveniently forget it also. We need to hold them accountable for what I believe most of them are guilty of insubordination.
Mm-hmm.
That's the easiest way I can explain it. And I don't know where you folks may have had work or worked in the past or where you do work now, but on my job, insubordination was grounds for suspension or dismissal.
Right.
And I believe that our Congress, our elected representatives, all too many of them look upon us with such contempt and make such wacky decisions allegedly on our behalf that I can make a case that they are guilty of insubordination. What do you think of that idea?
I think if we could get that into action, it could be very useful.
David, I have to thank you so much for visiting with me this Friday evening. You know, it's always a joy to chat with you. I've come to think of you as a good friend, certainly someone whose advice and insight I value and cherish. It's always good to get together with you, whether it's at TalkBorder.com or here on the Michael Cutler Hour. Great conversation, great points you've made. I just hope that you folks out there were listening to what David had to say, that you've written down those points about what you need to do to pick up the mantle of citizenship that's incumbent upon us to really and truly make the politicians accountable. You know, I think our nation stands at crossroads today. I think this, and we hear this all the time, but I really believe that this election, this coming November, is the most critically important election of a generation. And I think it is vital that we be full participants, not just vote. Certainly I want everyone out there voting. But please, please, educate yourself on the issues. David's suggestions were wonderful. Please make certain that you establish communications with those people who are elected to represent you out of a matter of fairness. They can't represent you if they don't hear from you what it is you expect.
Good point.
You know, you can't blame the waiter for bringing you the wrong food if you told him, just put some slop on the plate, I'll eat it. You know, then how could you complain and say you gave me the wrong slop? You know,
yep.
So really and truly, please, folks, live up to your obligations as citizens. Take this election more seriously, perhaps, than any that you've ever had the opportunity to be involved with, because these issues are critical, and we do stand at crossroads today. And that's the point to my program. That's the reason that I do what I do, whether it's here on this program or at TalkBorder.com or when I appear in the media. My goal is to make certain that we, the people, live up to our standards. I just got an interesting email that says most people can't find the restaurant. Well, this is true, but I hope this year at least they will find the voting booth. So with that in mind, I'm going to thank you, David, so much for having joined me today. I hope to have you back very soon. I certainly enjoyed the conversation, and I'm sure that my listeners out there enjoyed the conversation as well.
Terrific. Well, I certainly hope so, too.
So I thank you. And to all of you out there, let me give you three websites, michaelcutler.net, TalkBorder, one word, TalkBorder.com, or michaelcutler.net, and I think I did that already, and capsweb.org, C-A-P-S, capsweb.org. Folks, I always like to end commentaries with the simple statement that democracy is not a spectator sport. Please take those words seriously. Get involved. I'm counting on you. Have a wonderful weekend, everybody. I look forward to joining you again at the same time, at the same place next week here on the Michael Cutler Hour. Good night, everybody. Have a wonderful weekend.